New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Jonathan Hurd, a director at Altman Velandry, with more than 25 years of consulting and industry experience in communications, media, and related technology sectors. Currently, he leads their unique proprietary consumer survey and simulation techniques to analyze the impact of virtual MVPDs and skinny bundles of TV channels. It's pretty amazing stuff. Other recent projects include working with several cable TV networks and MVPDs on product and pricing strategy for over-the-top video offers. Earlier in his career, he served as a software development product manager in several industries, including financial services, computer peripherals, and video game development. And fun fact, he designed and created the classic Atari arcade video game Food Fight. He's a frequent speaker at industry conferences and author of articles about customer and channel segmentation, online content strategy, the future of video services, and partnership strategy, which is why we're so lucky to have him share some of his time with us today. Hi, Jonathan. Your firm has done some really amazing research, and there's a lot we could dive into. So I'm going to narrow down the focus onto a few key things, at least to start. And first, what I'd like to talk about is the relevance of network brands, because the entire idea of bundles and skinny bundles, which your awesome proprietary survey focuses on, is based on the presumption that the network brands are salient in viewing decisions. And so I really wanted to understand how you feel consumers, do they watch shows, do they watch channels, or is there some mix? How do you feel about that?
Well, thank you, Gabriella, first of all, for inviting me to participate in this podcast. I'm really glad to be talking with you about this. And yes, we're very excited about this research we've done in looking at skinny bundles. Network brands were the primary way that we evaluated consumer interest in the survey. Granted, shows are very important. And when we looked across 150 different network brands, everything from the major broadcasters to some regional sports networks that are highly local. So even Altitude in the Denver area, for example. But when we did that and we asked consumers about the value to them of these brands and their willingness to pay for these networks as part of their pay TV package, we did prompt them at times. There was a pop-up menu that showed the most popular programs on the network if they needed a reminder of that.
So you actually helped them understand what the network was. So you helped say, this is the content you get on that network. So that was part of the consumer experience in participating in the survey, that they were prompted and reminded of these things.
Yes, although it was an optional prompt. So, You know, imagine a page of network brands in a particular genre, let's say kids and animation. If they didn't know what one of those, you know, if they didn't know what Nickelodeon was, they could hover their mouse over Nickelodeon and see example programs that Nickelodeon offered. Now, I don't know how often those pop-ups actually were used
by
respondents.
That was my next question. I was like,
but
do you know?
I would suspect for, you know, the most popular networks, people either watch them or they don't. But when they think about them, they're thinking of particular brands. So I'll give you an example. In the survey, it turned out that ABC was very popular with 18 to 24-year-old women. And I asked the 18 to 24-year-old women in our office here, well, what's on ABC?
what are you watching?
Exactly. And they said, The Bachelorette, Dancing with the Stars, and Scandal. And so they knew it right off the top of their head. So those programs are clearly, for that age range, driving a lot of the interest in that brand. And but I would say that also there's enough programming for different age ranges, especially with the major networks, that other people would name different shows. So, okay. You know, men might name some of the sports that appear on ABC, or they might turn to it for some sports. Certainly for CBS, that's the case, you know, that it's the sports drive a lot of the popularity of CBS. It's, you know, it's a, people buy these pay TV package on the basis of channels today. Clearly the world is evolving, and Netflix has demonstrated that original programming is very important, and shows are, the rights to shows are acquired on a show by show basis in many cases from studios. So there's a, but Netflix itself is now taking on a brand value as effectively a channel in many ways, even though it's not shown in a linear fashion. But it, a lot of Netflix's value comes from House of Cards or Orange is the New Black. So, you know, what is the value of a distributor brand? It's a really a composite of the channels that are on it, but also, you know, the sort of new shows that, or the style of a show. So I'll give a different example, HGTV. You generally know the types of programming they're going to be on HGTV, right? So that as a brand of a channel probably is a lot more...
it's pretty salient. Yeah,
exactly. Whereas the major networks have a wide range of programming, a lot of which, and a lot of that value is driven by those individual programs.
Right. So we've known for like years that viewers, despite having, you know, every, I don't know, for years we were the 100 channel world, the 1,000 channel world, but in reality, viewers watched about 17 channels. And so the, you know, skinny bundling makes total sense. But I guess the trick is which 17 channels, which smaller number of channels are going to be selected. And within a household, is it the same channels? And I think your survey actually found some really interesting things, didn't it? About within the same household, how those things broke out.
Right, exactly. So you're absolutely right that we did ask decision makers for households, please answer these questions on behalf of your household. But even so, you know, when we ask, I'll give you an example, males 25 to 34 versus females 25 to 34, answering on behalf of their households, about a third, or actually more than a third, of the top 30 channels for their household now, about a third of them were not shared across males and females. So, for example, ESPN was the number one channel for males 25 to 34, and it did not even appear in the top 30 for females. Food Network was the number six channel for females 25 to 34, not even in the top 30 for males. So it's very difficult to create a skinny bundle that satisfies the needs of more than, you know, a single digits fraction of the population. Now, it depends on how you define skinny. But if you think of a package that's in the range of, say, $20 to $30, and then you start adding up the fees necessary to pay the content owners for that, you know, for that content, it's really hard to assemble a skinny bundle that meets the needs of even within a household. But then we think, well, how many households are out there that would subscribe to this? It's very challenging to create that sort of magical skinny bundle.
Right. One of the things that I found interesting was that History Channel was listed as a must-have. That doesn't seem to square with ratings, though. And does it?
Yeah. So here's the way I've been telling cable networks to think about this. And right now, cable networks have a great way of assessing the value of their channels and their programming from an ad revenue perspective. They have Nielsen ratings. That may not be the greatest way, but it is the way the industry evaluates the value of programming. How many people actually watch this program? Now, but consumers have, and the affiliate fees that cable networks get and then they're paid those by cable operators and other MVPDs. Those affiliate fees are driven by how much consumers are willing to pay for those channels. So History Channel is a great example. It's not watched that much in comparison to many other channels, but it was fourth on the list in terms of the percentage of respondents saying it's a must-have for their household. So, and here's another great example. Weather Channel was seventh on the list, and it was about 36% of households that said they must have the Weather Channel. Now, people don't sit around all day watching the Weather Channel, but it might be a really important part of their routine. So maybe for 10 minutes in the morning, they watch the Weather Channel and then they go off. And so to them, it's a must have. And they're willing, it ends up having a high value in terms of willingness to pay, but not necessarily from a watching and an ad revenue perspective. And I think, you know, History Channel, Discovery Channel, which was right behind it, those are things that households probably think, well, it's good for me or good for my kids or good for other people in the household to have that as an option. But they may turn to it only a bit in comparison to some of the other channels.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, especially if you think of the person who is answering on behalf of the household saying, yes, my children, they should watch this. Somebody else in the household should watch this, but maybe they aren't actually watching it. I mean, certainly I think there's a difference between History Channel and Discovery and weather. I can see what you're saying about weather, how that, you know, it's important where it's relevant for me. But
Right. Another
question I had for you had to do with the sharing economy and sharing of passwords and borrowing of accounts and what that might mean for people if you're developing smaller bundles. Does that mean that people can access, will they seek out this other content in a pirated way? Will they borrow other people's passwords? Or what do you think about outside of your household, what you've said you're going to pay for, the a la carte wanting of the odd thing? How would that fold into it?
Well, we looked at account sharing for online subscription services. So, for example, Netflix, HBO Now, Hulu Plus, Amazon Prime, as just some examples. And what we asked respondents in the survey is, what account are you using? Or, you know, describe how you're watching this content. And the options we gave them were, I use my own account, my household subscribes, and I use that account, which is legit, right?
Right.
I use the account of a family member who lives in another household. That's, you know, kind of password sharing,
right?
Probably for most of these services outside the realm of what they would consider fair use.
Right.
And then I use the account of a friend or someone else. That's definitely, you know, something that isn't intended. We also asked if they're using a free trial. Mm-hmm. So when we looked at that for Netflix across age ranges, we found that the vast majority of people are using their own account or the household subscribes and they use that account. So, for example, in the 35 to 44 year old age range, we had fully 93% of respondents saying that they're using their own account or they're someone in their household's account. Hmm. So that's pretty good. Where we saw that number being lower is in the 18 to 24 year old age range, kind of not surprisingly there, right? That you'd think that age range would be more likely to be sharing or using someone else's password, let's say.
Right.
And so that's only 82% of respondents said that they're using their own or someone in their household's account. And then there were 12% that said using the account of a family member who lives in another household, and 5% who use the account of a friend or someone else. So there is a fair amount of password sharing going on with younger consumers. Interestingly, the other age range where there were people using someone else's account were 55 plus. So we had 11% of 55 plus who watch Netflix saying that they use the account of a family member who lives in another household. Probably their children who helped get them set up on Netflix. And so, you know, there is there's a fair amount of sharing going on, but it actually is relatively stable. When you look across Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu Plus, et cetera, it is usually in the range of 7 to 10% of households of users of each of those services that are using someone else's account. In other words, the account of someone not in their household.
When we had surveyed, we had looked at a slightly younger slice, and we were finding that 3 out of 5 young millennials were sharing logins, and that it was absolutely linked to the economics. You know, if they were economically dependent, they were more inclined to share than if they weren't. But it was interesting. Now, do you think that, like, I've read that Reed Hastings from Netflix or HBO's Richard Plepler believe that sharing passwords is good for their companies, that this creates people, it gives people a taste of the content and then they'll eventually buy it, that it's kind of promotion, if you will. Do you agree, and do you think that they really believe that, or they're just making a nice way to dress up something they can't change?
Well, it's difficult to regulate this in a way that's user-friendly, but I think over time we'll see more and more, more and more of this happening. And so one interesting thing, if it's about generating new users and it's kind of a way of,
well, that's a metric,
word of mouth, right?
Marketing, right?
Yeah, I mean, so it is definitely a way of, when you share passwords, you would hope that people would ultimately subscribe and get their own account. So we did ask about that. Mm-hmm. We asked, by age range, you indicate that you use an account of someone other than yourself. How likely is it that you'll get your own paid account within the next year? And the range there was for 18 to 44-year-olds, a much higher percentage, you know, roughly in the range of 45 to high 40s%, like 45 to 47%, roughly. It was a lot smaller for older respondents. So only 21% of 55 plus agreed that it was, or said it was likely that they'd get their own account. And by the way, that 55 plus throughout the entire survey, anything having to do with price, that age segment is the most price sensitive, who feel that they are wasting money, for example, by watching TV channels or by having to pay for TV channels that they don't watch. They're more price sensitive in the choice instruments that we created, the simulator. They're more price sensitive there. But I wanted to go back to one other aspect of account sharing. Nearly all of these services have some kind of a free trial. You know, if you sign up with an email address and credit card that these services haven't seen before, you get 30 days to try it. And for emerging services like Sling TV, we had 13% of respondents who use Sling TV saying that they were on a free trial. It's only 1% for Netflix. So account sharing and free trial, you know, in some ways they go hand in hand. In other words, that they give people an opportunity to try something, especially in the earlier days of a service, an opportunity for these services to generate some traction in the market. But then, you know, these services also do have to put some kind of controls in place so that they're not violating the content negotiations that they've made, and also to ensure that over time, they're not limiting their potential. So I think there will be clever ways of making sure that password sharing is more limited, and also that people who are authorized don't have to enter their passwords. You know, it'll recognize the device you used, for example,
right.
or recognize your home IP address. Once you start doing that and making it easier for people to sign on to some of these services, then that will also help the user experience.
Absolutely, because there's nothing more annoying than having to sign in a million times. I find that really frustrating. One of the things you said earlier, and I think it's really interesting, was about that 55 plus segment, that population. And it sort of surprised me because we always think about the cheap millennials, but you don't think about the cheap grandma and grandpas, or not even grandma and grandpas, 55. That's not that old. certainly not that old. And what I find interesting there is that then becomes a question for networks. Do they, or cable, package people, do they want to create these skinny bundles? Because are they going to cannibalize their subscriber? Like, who's going to really dump? Are you going to be appealing to these cord nevers? Are you really going to onboard the cord nevers? Or are you going to lose your foundation viewer, your traditional TV viewer? Because they're waiting for the opportunity to dump channels.
Yeah, and that was one of our key takeaways as well after looking at the results of the research. I was surprised, when we asked the question or gave the respondents the statement, I am wasting money because my pay TV service includes many channels that my household does not watch. Two-thirds of those 45 and above, so 66% of 45 to 54s and 66% also of 55 plus, agreed with that statement, and it was less than 50% for 18 to 24-year-olds. So that feeling of, wasting money or the channels not being as valuable and having, hundreds of channels not being as valuable was more concentrated in older users. Now, interestingly, those older users also value wired service to their household, so cable service or fiber or whatever, versus over the top, as it's called, or public internet delivery of service. The utility of delivering a pay TV service over the internet falls dramatically in older respondents. So, thinking about this, if you were to create, let's say you're a major MVPD like Comcast, if you were attempting to attract millennials, then you might be tempted to come out with a skinny bundle, thinking that millennials are more price sensitive or, aren't as interested in TV or, they don't subscribe at as high a level, which is absolutely true. So you might be tempted to create a skinny bundle to attract millennials and deliver it over your cabling, right, as a standard offer. If you do that, you are more likely to get adoption by these older respondents who are more price sensitive and feel like they're wasting money for paying for too many channels. So you'd end up cannibalizing those respondents who are paying for your service today. If you deliver it over the internet, then you've got a better chance of fencing off those older respondents who don't value internet delivery as much. So that's the challenge here. And by the way, delivering those packages over the internet, though, as we were talking about earlier, it's very hard to generate any significant demand at price points that are affordable. Hmm. It's almost like, you've got this group of, right now it's in the range of 17% of U.S. households that don't subscribe to pay TV. The question is, can you come up with some offer that appeals to them without cannibalizing the people who are paying for pay TV today? And that's what's really tough to do, because you put an offer out there, it's far more likely to cannibalize existing subscribers than it is to generate new demand.
Right. Well, that brings me actually to think a little bit about TV Everywhere and thinking about the value people get with the full package and the flexibility, trying to say, look how great this is. Do you think that subscriber awareness seems to actually be an issue. Is that fair to say, do you think?
Oh, it's absolutely an issue. And it has, so we measured across all respondents, about 36% are aware. 36% of those who subscribe to pay TV from a major MVPD, in other words, one of the top 10 who all offer TV everywhere, only about 36% were aware that their provider actually offers TV everywhere. And we defined TV everywhere quite simply as the ability to watch TV shows and movies on devices other than your TV set. You know, does your provider give you that capability? And only 36% said yes. And it was about the same 3 years ago in our survey, 36% as well. So we think of this as a missed opportunity, really, because
right.
For one thing, those who are aware that their provider offers it, when we ask, well, how often do you use it? Those who are aware, it's 2/3 of those 18 to 24 year olds, and 83% of those 25 to 34 year olds, and 72% of 35 to 44. It drops off quite a bit with older respondents. Again, they're just not as comfortable watching TV shows and movies over the internet, period. But this is a great way, you know, for those who are aware of it, it's a great way to have engagement and create stickiness with your subscribers. We asked those who were not aware of TV everywhere, but whose provider does in fact offer it, you know, we asked them, well, how often do you think you would use it if it were offered by your provider? And more than half of those, in fact, 59% of 18 to 24 year olds and 56% of 25 to 34 year olds said that they thought they would use it at least monthly. So, you know, here we're wondering, well, how do we attract millennials? How do we retain millennials, right? And TV everywhere, what a great way to do it. And it's just, the awareness building
so that,
really has not happened.
Right. So that piece could actually solve a huge part of the problem. So it really gets to discoverability. And do you have a strategy perspective on what companies should be doing to inform viewers, especially these younger viewers, of their services? I know that's not really the purview of this survey per se, but you must have some thoughts around, you know, 3 years, we didn't move the needle. What should these networks, what should Comcast be doing?
Yeah. So any MVPD is out there trying to understand how to meet the needs of millennials. And so the question would be not how do we raise awareness overall across all consumers, because we already know that older respondents aren't as likely to use the internet. And millennials are the ones who are cord-nevering or cutting the cord. So how do we target millennials and how do we appeal to them? And I think there the idea would be to use campaigns that others have found to be successful, or media that others have found to be successful in targeting millennials. So, for example, influencers. Millennials, many companies are using influencers to generate awareness for their products and intent. And so that would seem to be one of a variety of ways, of millennial-focused ways, to raise awareness.
Right, right. Very interesting. Well, thank you so much for your time and fascinating conversation. And I think your survey is super fantastic and amazing. And everybody should make an appointment to talk to you about your survey, because it's really cool data, which nobody else has. So
that would be great. And thank you very much, Gabriella. This has been a pleasure.
And that wraps up another episode of Up Next. I want to close by thanking some people who have made the podcast possible. First, my friend Rob Naughton, who is the voice artist who kindly does our intro. Thank you. A big thank you to my great production team at Microfame Media. Thanks, too, to our guest and new friend, Jonathan Hurd. And, of course, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you for listening. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.